You're on KHUM, Garberville, Eureka Arcade Online at khum.com. And over here to the left, it's Amy Stewart.
Here I am.
You are.
Hello.
First of all, it's great to see you.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Last time you were here, you were not a New York Times bestselling author. Actually, you were, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you were. Congratulations.
I don't know what to do with that.
Your new book is, I checked last night, it's still at number 8 on the New York Times hardcover advice list.
Yes, sir.
Congratulations.
Thank you. You know, it's me versus the diet books and the Facebook woman's book.
Right.
Do you know what else I'm competing against?
I think you're competing against Bill O'Reilly's book about Lincoln.
And I could pee on this.
You're in great company.
That cat book. My publicist said, this totally makes sense because sometimes I get drunk and I pee on all kinds of stuff.
Oh, we all have stories like that.
So it works. I'm taking that book down.
You will.
Yeah.
I really can't. I mean, first of all, your book is great and worthy of this chart position. And
well,
I know you're
you.
Not in it for the numbers.
No.
But they don't hurt.
They don't hurt.
You've been on NPR.
That's a thing. Yeah.
I don't even care about that. You've been
no,
on JPR.
Because I've been here.
Yeah. Oh.
This is what matters.
Look, this is, they opened for us. But really,
right.
I'm curious. Look, we're going to talk about your book in a sec.
Yeah.
What was it like being at Google? They invited you to speak there.
Yeah. Google is amazing. So they, you know, it's not cool enough to work at Google already. So they bring in authors just to entertain people during the day. And so they called me up and I said, well, why don't we do it all about tequila? Because they wanted to do a tasting. And I said, let's just do all agave-based spirits, tequila, mezcal, sotol, bacanora, and I'll theme it around that. And they said, okay, so we'll buy that stuff and we'll do a tasting. Just tell us what to buy. And idiot that I am, I was like, well, let me know what your budget is because this stuff can get kind of expensive. Like it's Google, you know? So there's like this awkward pause and they're like, yeah, seriously, just tell us what to buy. I mean,
yeah, we'll get it. Don't worry.
Right. Like we'll just go buy Mexico and you can pick out what you want, you know? So we had the most extraordinary stuff to taste.
Did you take Google to the cleaners?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I made them pay. They're going to pay, man. top shelf stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great. It's just kind of the engineers sitting around, you know, and they get free books, right? So I don't, which is also, it's so much fun to not have to sell the books, but to just give them away because everyone just takes one. It's like this frenzy and it just feels so great.
It's like at a talk show where they're like, reach under your chair, except
that's right.
They're not even on TV. That's how rich Google is.
Yeah.
Just buy everybody books.
And they said, you know, your talk is the most popular talk since we had the cast of Modern Family down here.
What?
Like, seriously,
nice.
me and the cast of Modern Family. But they didn't have tequila was the thing.
Modern Family's a pretty good show, though.
It's all right.
It's pretty good.
It's okay.
All right. So you, Amy Stewart, you have a new book. People can go to khum.com and read all about it. They can also buy it at your bookstore.
Eureka Books.
Eureka Books.
That's right.
Antiquarian Bookstore.
Yes.
So it's there. And of course, you will be talking in greater detail than we have time for today at Eureka Theater for Arts Alive at 5 o'clock.
For Arts Alive at 5 o'clock. That's right.
Exactly.
That's fun.
This book is amazing.
Well, thank you.
Because
right?
We'll talk about all the stuff in here, but I want to talk about how it pertains to us in Humboldt
of
County.
Of course.
First.
Now, it's all about Humboldt.
I have brought you this.
Oh.
That is.
A brewski.
Yeah, well, look, you don't have to drink it.
Sweet.
I would if you open it and don't, but.
Yeah.
That is Lost Coast Brewery.
Yes,
Indica Pale
is.
Ale.
Right.
How many plants do you think are in there?
So generally, of course, beer is made primarily with barley because barley has this weird magical power. Would you like me to?
Yeah.
Do you want all this detail? Okay. So barley is a grain and a grain is just a seed, right? So seeds have a little bit of sugar stored in them. The plant puts some sugar in there because when the seed starts to sprout, it's going to need some food until it can put down roots and put up leaves and make its own food. So they pack a little sugar in there in the form of starch, because if they just left it as sugar, it would rot, like fruit on a tree can rot. So they put it in there as starch. When the seed gets wet, these enzymes inside the seed bust the starch back into sugar, so the little seedling will have something to eat. Barley is incredibly high in those enzymes, so it will not only bust its own starch into sugar, but it will go to work on anything else in the mash tub, like corn or rye or any other grain. So...
Okay. I gotcha. This, by the way, you just actually made sense of something that I've been trying to figure out since I was 19. Like, now I finally get how that works.
So that's what malted barley is. Malted barley is just barley that has been gotten wet, so it'll start to germinate. So there's little roots growing all over malted barley. So there's always barley in beer. They can put in other things. Budweiser is primarily rice, for example, because it's cheap and available and kind of neutral in taste.
Wait, Budweiser puts rice in beer?
Oh, yeah. It's almost, yeah, that's their main grain. That's not like a secret. I mean, that is how they do it.
That is... Well, okay, look, I'm not drinking a lot of Budweiser, so.
I mean, you know, around the world, there's a lot of different grains that can be used.
Okay, now also on the local front.
Yes.
We are about to get, in Humboldt County, a distillery.
I know.
Right?
I'm so excited. Do you even know what they're making? Do you know anything about what they're doing?
This is what I want to ask you, because in your book, The Drunken Botanist, out
yes.
now,
right.
you talk about the genetics of apples and, and how their gene pool, is, like the genetics of apples are more complicated than humans.
Right.
And we've got that orchard in Fortuna, and there are 100 ways that you could spin apple into booze. Let's talk about apples and booze and what might be.
Yeah, and so here's what's really important about that, and this is something everyone should understand, is that making booze is actually very helpful to farmers, because all the produce that you can't sell, maybe it's the wrong shape, it's the wrong size, it's got a bug bite in it, it has a blemish, for whatever reason it can't go to market, throw it in the hopper, man, and make booze out of it. So, like, I interviewed a guy making potato vodka up in British Columbia, and that's his deal. He goes to all the potato farmers, and he says, I don't want to take any potatoes out of the food supply. I just want the potatoes you can't sell, and I'm going to make vodka. So if we had somebody here doing that with apples, either to make hard cider, I mean, I feel like every brewery in Humboldt ought to have, you know, local hard cider on tap. I can't believe we don't have it.
This is a missing marketing opportunity.
Totally. And then also to do a nice apple brandy. There's no reason we shouldn't have a great apple brandy. Now, the equipment's different. So I don't know if this distillery in Fortuna has the right equipment to do fruit brandies, because that's a little different than vodka or whiskey. But if they do, this is my plea to them. Please do something with apples.
Okay.
Even make an apple vodka. That would be awesome.
Oh, man. By the way, if you are just tuning in, Amy Stewart, Drunken Botanist is the book. You can go over to khum.com, and we have a bunch of keywords that we are going to check through.
Oh, no.
All right?
Is this a quiz?
No, it's not a quiz. Yeah, it's a quiz on your own book. Luckily, you did the reading.
I didn't study.
And the writing. Okay, so you had mentioned potatoes, and that's the first of these keywords.
Okay.
And I'm glad you brought it up. Talk about artisanal potatoes, because that sounds so Portland, Oregon, that I just wanted to vomit in this garbage can right here.
Oh, don't do that.
I'm not going to.
You know, it's actually Swedish. There's actually a Swedish distiller of potato vodka, Carlson, and they're doing these very high-end varietal potato vodkas. So in other words, they go out into the fields and they pick a particular potato that they feel makes better vodka than any other. And they bottle it with the name of the potato on it. So very specialized. And that's very different, actually, than traditionally how you would do this kind of stuff. I mean, you know, back in the day when you were doing potato vodka or you were doing something with apples or any other fruit, the more varieties you mix in, the better. Because it's sort of a more well-rounded flavor, and if there's sort of one variety is a little hard to work with and it is made up for by another one. So this whole artisanal single variety thing is something that people are sort of copying from the wine industry, and I'm not sure it works for spirits, but they're super into it.
So the book is a perfect marriage of, first of all, a great research project. How drunk did you get? Did you ever actually just get just to the wall hammered for this book?
Well, so here's the thing. I mean, in terms of that kind of research, the best place to do it is at Tales of the Cocktail, which is this annual cocktail conference in New Orleans every July. So I've been going every year now for several years. And you sign up for seminars. And so a seminar, an example of a seminar might be, you know, the history of rum or something like that. And they start at 10 o'clock in the morning and you sit at a table. And when you sit down, there's six little pours of the most exquisite rums you'll ever taste in your life. And then they're going to come around with two or three cocktails made from those rums as well. So that's like, you know, it's eight or nine little pours and that's at 10 o'clock in the morning. And you'll do two or three more of those throughout the day and hit tasting rooms in between them. So the thing at Tales has come to be to tweet out like every drink you have that day. And it ends up being like, you know, 48 things, but a little bit of each. And I have to say, professional drinkers are surprisingly responsible. There's a lot of dumping and spitting and not getting hammered at Tales.
Yeah, I would say, and you're saying you're professional drinkers, like literally, like I mean,
like bartenders and distillers and booze writers. I mean, there's a whole industry, and so there are a lot of people out there who do kind of drink for a living, and they're really restrained. And part of it is just you get very blasé. It's like somebody offers you something, and it's like, come on, I've had.
Yeah,
you know, I've had 100 rums better than that. Why should I? Why do I?
I'm glad that? Your cousin made that good for her. But this is, you know, I got a work job to do here.
Right.
Okay. So the book is in three main chunks.
Yes.
Talk about how you decided to break this up.
Right. So I decided to just kind of follow the process that alcohol, that plants take to be made into alcohol. So it starts with plants that you actually ferment or distill to get the alcohol. So that's like apples, grapes, barley, agave, sugarcane,
corn.
Yeah, all that stuff. And then there's all the things that get added at the distillery to flavor it. So in the case of beer, I mean, we're holding this bottle of beer, so like hops, that's a flavoring. Juniper for gin, all that stuff. And that's like actually most of the book is all those flavorings. And then the third part are the things that you would mix, like the mixers and garnishes. So plants that you might either grow in your garden or get at the farmer's market or keep behind the bar to actually mix into a cocktail.
Okay, so we're gonna have to take a break here in just a sec. Before we do that, I want to ask about Ben Franklin, who I thought invented beer, but it turns out he stole it from this lady. And why is she not famous?
Did you really think that?
I'm stupid.
No. It's interesting to me how widely known that is. So spruce beer, widely attributed to Ben Franklin. It turns out that he had just copied the recipe out of a cookbook by Hannah Glass. He wasn't stealing from her. It's just like, that's what you would do, right? Write it down so you could make the beer later. And it was found in his papers when he died, along with about 12 or 13 other things that have been wrongfully attributed to him as like his invention. But his archivists have since established that, no, these were just things he copied out for his use. So I found that recipe in Hannah Glass's book and confirmed the whole thing with like the Ben Franklin archive. So I have busted that myth. It was not him. It was Hannah Glass.
But in Ben Franklin's defense, because his ghost is sitting right over there and staring at me, he wasn't trying to take credit.
He wasn't trying to pass it off as his own. It was just some notes that he wrote down. But you know how crazy people are about Ben Franklin. And so the other interesting thing, also Jane Austen was very into spruce beer and wrote about it in her letters and used it in Emma. It's like a little plot twist in Emma. And it's just interesting to me, like there's all this beer literature, mostly written by men. And here's these two women, Hannah Glass and Jane Austen, who never get mentioned. So I have restored them to their rightful place.
Exactly.
In the spruce beer literature.
You will be at Eureka Theater, 5 p.m. You'll be giving plants away. We'll talk about that when we come back from the break, because you have a line of plants. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's really, really cool. All right. That's cool. Keep it here. It's KHUM. Amy Stewart, New York Times bestselling author. Is in the building for reasons we still don't understand. We'll be right back. It's KHUM Radio over here. Amy Stewart, New York Times bestselling author. I'm going to keep saying that until it makes you embarrassed.
You've succeeded. We're done.
Okay.
Enough.
Well, look, it's fantastic that you have found this niche that just seems like a fun, like you focus on the devilish side of nature as it intersects with human sin, basically.
Right. What else do we do but sin, really?
Is that also why you're not going to tell us what your next book is about?
That's one of many reasons.
Well, okay, so Drunken Botanist, the plants that create the world's great drinks. We're going to move on to the next keyword here. We'll get all of these.
Okay.
Fermentation archaeologist.
Ah.
Speaking of people with crazy jobs.
Right.
Is this Patrick McGovern?
Yes, Patrick McGovern. Yeah, that's an actual job. So what he does is he goes around and he analyzes the residue on pottery shards found at archaeological digs to see what people were fermenting and what they were drinking 10,000 years ago.
So you say fermentation archaeologist, but I say party historian.
Right.
The keggers of history is his ballpark there.
That's what he does. And so not only does he recreate these recipes from 8,000 or 10,000 years ago, but then he has teamed up with Dogfish Head Brewery, and they make them.
So they're recreating
Yeah.
these ancient party drinks.
Right. some of which are really weird. Like they might have muscat grapes and barley and saffron, like weird herbs. And then they're not quite wine, but they're not quite beer because they have like a little bit of everything in them. And what he told me, so I interviewed him, and what he told me is this stuff was funky. It was cloudy. It had, you know, bugs swimming in it. It had stuff floating in it. And so the vessels that we humans used to drink out of had straws that went into the middle of the beverage because you didn't want to drink from the top because you don't know what's living up there. And you didn't want to drink from the bottom because of whatever had sunk to the bottom. So you just sort of pull it out of the middle.
Now, speaking
Isn't
of
crazy.
Yeah, it is. But it makes sense, too. It's survival. Like, I want to get drunk, but I also don't want to die.
Right.
I don't want to drink that weird bug that's in the bottom.
Right.
Which, by the way, mezcal, short version, we don't even need to talk about that. Don't drink mezcal if it's got a bug in it.
No, that's awful. A gimmick. That is cheap, nasty stuff. Don't do it.
You look like an idiot doing that.
Yeah, right.
So back to history.
Yes.
I thought that humans domesticated like cows and dogs first, but you say the first domesticated organism is in fact...
Yeast.
Yeast.
Right.
First of all, how do we domesticate yeast? And secondly, when was that?
Well, so easily going back 8 or 10,000 years, maybe even a little more. You know, part of it is now archaeologists have the ability to use really sophisticated equipment and get really accurate. So they're sort of rethinking timelines on a lot of stuff. But the way we do it, you know, there's debates over how this first happened. But the strain of yeast that we use to ferment is actually was living off the exudates of the bark of oak trees. So people think, oh, it's the yeast that was living on the skin of the grape. No, it wasn't. It was on oak trees. So it could be that the grapevine climbed up an oak tree. It could be that, you know, somebody was gathering acorns and grapes at the same time. It's one of those like, your chocolate got in my peanut butter. No, you're like, we don't really know quite how that happy accident happened. But somehow it started to be used. And once that started, then it's in the brewing equipment. It's living in the bucket that you're using to make beer, and it gets in the walls of your little hut or your cave or whatever. So we really domesticated it without knowing we were doing it just because it was inhabiting everything.
Now, you, in the book, you talk about, you know, the plants, like, you know, and grapes and berries and like all the barley, corn, the things that we all know go into alcohol.
Right.
It still trips me out because now I look at beer and go, that's a plant. In there, you know,
yeah.
I guess everything.
Jen, bunch of plants.
Yeah, somebody pointed out that everything is plants.
That's right.
So that's true too.
That's
but,
the whole deal.
But you talk about fungi, mm-hmm. which are involved in booze. But you talk a lot about wood, and you talk about oak.
Right.
So oak barrels is the only American oak barrels are important to us. How?
Bourbon. So if you're going to call it bourbon, then the law says that you have to age it in a brand new American oak barrel. So that means it can never have been used for anything else. So as you can imagine, it was probably the makers of oak barrels, you know, it was the Coopers Union who probably got that into law, right?
Is this the same sort of law that says if it's not from Champagne, France, it's sparkling wine?
Right. Yeah, it's all of that stuff that defines, you know, what it is and why you can call it that. So if it's going to be bourbon, it has to be at least 51% corn. New American oak barrel. So what that means is you put bourbon into a barrel, and basically you're just putting a solvent up against wood, and you are extracting wood flavors out of the oak. And American oak trees happen to be really high in vanillin, which is the same exact thing that gives vanilla beans its flavor. So much so that sawdust is used to make artificial vanilla flavoring.
Really?
Yeah. That's where that...
Whoa.
Sawdust.
Let me pick my brain up just for a second. I feel terrible about that. But in a sense, you also talk about sawdust competes for the title of most expensive spice on earth with saffron. I mean, sawdust. Sorry. Vanilla.
Vanilla.
Excuse me.
Yeah, vanilla. Right. So that's why, you know, artificial vanilla has to come from something other than vanilla beans, because vanilla beans are so expensive. They're really hard to grow. They, you know, it's an orchid, and it can only be pollinated by one species of bee that does not want to just go live in a factory somewhere.
Like
so,
a gentle bee, right? Like a stingerless bee?
A little sweet, little tiny bee. Yeah. And so they have to be done artificially, basically by hand. Somebody has to do that job.
So I always thought of vanilla as sort of run-of-the-mill... You know, cheese, not cheese, but like sort of commoner flavor. Like when you go out and get vanilla ice cream, you're settling, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you write in the book about vanilla's role in booze and just the, like you said, it's impossible, almost impossible to get it to germinate. They had to figure out how to do little bamboo pricks, like to, it's just...
To fertilize. Oh, yeah. No, it's really complicated. And then you have to lay them out and sweat them. They actually ferment a little bit. So there's even fermentation just in like processing them. So vanilla is very tricky, but vanilla flavors can also come from wood. They're making the same flavor compound, vanillin. They're making that same compound. So that's why a nicely aged bourbon is really sweet. It's got a lot of vanilla flavors. And then once they're done with the barrels, they sell them off. So there's Scotch distilleries that use bourbon barrels and rum in the Caribbean. So they get reused over and over again. But that first flavor, you know, the most strong vanilla, sweet, caramelized flavors end up in the bourbon.
And are those virgin bourbon barrels like at a premium? Sort of like virgin olive oil. Like if you get a brand new oak barrel, is that the sort of thing that can only be used in America? Or can you sell a brand new American oak barrel to Canada for their Canadian bourbon distilleries?
I mean, one could be sold there, but you know, the people who make these barrels, it's a very specialized thing and it's done according to really careful standards. Some distillers even want only certain parts of the tree used. So they'll say, we only want trunk wood or we only want branch wood because the how fine the grain is different. So it's a real art form, very particular.
Amy Stewart is here. Her book is Drunken Botanist. And again, khum.com has some more details. I wanted to ask you, before we bring things into the present day, who was Amédée François Frazier?
Oh, Frazier. Yeah. Strawberries. So he went to Chile. He was actually there on some other kind of expedition. He wasn't even there as a botanist. I think he was mapping the coast of Chile. He had some other job he had to do there. But while he was there, he picked up these enormous Chilean strawberries, huge fruit. No one had ever seen strawberries the size that you and I get at the grocery store.
Right.
Yeah, none of these Europeans who were coming into Latin America had ever seen anything like this, because all they had were these tiny little woodland strawberries that were like the size of a raisin, maybe. So he brought some back, but he didn't realize that he was only bringing back females.
Right.
That didn't do you much good. And of the ones he brought back, only like one or two survived in the end because this long ocean voyage. And it took a long time to figure out what to mate them with because they didn't have any males. But he's the one who's really responsible for the modern strawberry as we understand it.
And that also checks off our third keyword, bisexual strawberries.
Oh, good. I'm glad we got to that.
I think we can also check off hysterical water, which was a side project that Hannah, the real inventor
Hannah
of beer.
Glass. Hannah Glass. It was Glass. One of her recipes.
What's hysterical water and have you had it?
You know, I have not had it. I'm dying to make it. It's got like cinnamon, cloves, you know, various herbs and spices. I think there's dates in it and black millipedes.
Ugh.
Dried millipedes. And you soak all that in brandy. And then she says, add sugar to taste. And I'm like, how much sugar do you need to cover up the taste of dried millipedes?
Is that an alcoholic drink?
You know, this is 1747 when that was published. So this would have been medicinal bordering. This was in that time when it was still a fine line between medicine and cocktails.
So let's fast forward sort of to, you know, talk about medicinal alcohol. And there's a section where you talk about agave and how hard it is to make booze with agave, and yet tequila industry seems to be doing fine. But at the very low end of agave alcohol production is, it's a very simple thing.
Pulque,
the one.
Yeah. So it's made from the sap. So very different process. You leave the plant in the ground, you leave it alive, you just sort of carve out the center of it right before it's about to bloom, and it basically starts to bleed is what it does. It starts producing all this sap to try to heal this big wound that you've inflicted on it. And so you pull all that sap out and it'll produce, it's almost like milking a cow. I mean, it'll just keep producing far more sap than would ever be in the plant at any one time. So you get a lot of it out and you ferment that to make pulque, which is only, you know, same alcohol level as beer, right? Maybe 4 or 5% alcohol. And it's kind of an acquired taste, sort of sour, a little bit yogurty, maybe.
And there's a tiny time frame that you can drink it too, right?
Yeah, because it's actively fermenting. They don't, you know, this bottle of beer, they stop the fermentation process, obviously, or it would have exploded by now. But they don't stop the fermentation process with pulque. So you have to drink it while it's fresh. You'll never see it sold in stores.
But since it's basically, you know, it's just fermenting sap, like there's got to be a bunch of healthy stuff in there.
Right. There's a lot of nutrients in it. There's B vitamins and amino acids. So it's something that native people have been making since forever. I mean, it goes way back in Latin American history. And it is kind of a health drink. And similar thing in Africa, where very often the dregs of these things would be fed to babies. I mean, you know, the sort of sediment in the bottom is low in alcohol and high in nutrients.
Man.
I know, amazing.
God, how fun was this to write?
It was great.
Research, did you go to South America?
No, I didn't get to go to South America, but I went around Europe and visited a lot of distilleries and, of course, a lot of, you know, distilleries here in this country, and I got to drink some amazing stuff.
Amy Stewart, speaking tomorrow, 5 p.m., everybody go to the Eureka Theater. There's going to be a ton of stuff to do and to learn, and the book is The Drunken Botanist. And when you were researching this, like, there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation.
Yes.
Like, for instance, the Ben Franklin myth about Ben Franklin and beer, right? But then you've also got corporate secrets because nobody wants to really tip the hand as to what's in there. How much debunking did you find yourself doing when researching the book?
I really looked for that stuff because I love being able to prove people wrong, right? It's just so much fun to do. So any story about a famous person, I was very suspicious of. Anytime you hear Marie Antoinette did this or Cleopatra did that, like, probably not. So, you know, I would just look at that and go, no, they didn't. And I'd go try to track it down or try to prove it. And definitely, especially the European distillers, there's this real tradition of it's a secret that's been handed down for 200 years and, you know, King George got this recipe from his footman and then he was kidnapped and he had to trade it to win his freedom. And, you know, I mean, all these like absurd myths, whereas American distillers tend to be, especially now, like the new craft distillers are very open. They're like, we want to celebrate our ingredients. Like, we think this stuff is amazing. We want to talk about it.
And it seems like in a lot of cases, the fewer ingredients, the cooler it is. Like, we've got three things in here. And look how badass we've been able to make this. But on the other hand of that spectrum, you talk about a drink like the martini, which can have how many plants in it?
I mean, easily 20. It would not surprise me at all.
Well, how are you going to fit 20
Actually
plants
more.
In a martini?
Well, gin is going to have probably 8 or 10. I mean, first of all, the base alcohol is probably made from a mixture of grains. So you've got that.
Like 4 or 5, like a blend of different grains.
Could be, okay. Yeah, could be. And then you've got to have juniper in order to call it gin. And there's usually citrus peel. There's usually cilantro seeds, coriander, cardamom. So there's, you know, usually 8 or 10 spices that go into making gin. And then the vermouth is wine, so that's grapes. And then, again, a bunch of herbs and spices and fruit get added to that. So easily another 8 or 10 ingredients. And then you have the olive or the lemon
twist.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, okay. So that adds up.
So it adds up.
Now, you, New York Times bestselling author Amy Stewart.
I thought you were going to stop that.
No, now it's for sport.
Okay.
You have to drink in this town. Where do you go get your drinks? Because in your book, I remember going, wow, she's being kind of harsh to modern bartenders.
So I have to confess, it's hard for me to go out in Humboldt County and spend much money on drinks. Only because I have such an amazing liquor collection at home right now. I do.
Okay, you've I got
mean,
pro.
I have. You know, it was all a tax write-off the whole time I was writing this. So there were no breaks on what I would spend on booze. So I have this astonishing collection of stuff at home. So if I'm out, I'm just ordering something to go with what I'm having to eat. So, you know, if I'm at Lost Coast Brewery, I'm just going to have a beer or whatever. Like, I don't really go out to drink.
Okay.
Because
so
I'd rather just invite everybody over to my house.
And you guys have a mixology party.
Right. Okay. And I have invited you to several of those, by the
you
way.
You have. Oh, my God. And I never went. And I have another. Tell me what's wrong with bartenders.
Okay. First of all, serving sizes are way too big. And I see this in Humboldt County all the time. I will order a martini and they will bring it to me in what has gotten to be the standard martini glass in restaurants.
8 ounce.
8 ounce. That is one cup. That is an entire cup of gin. So that's 4 drinks.
Because a drink in spirits is defined as an ounce and a half.
An ounce and a half, then you add some vermouth and whatever, you know, 2 ounces max for something like a martini. They bring you 8 ounces, and sometimes they'll bring it to you with a little glass thing on the side with the extra gin that was in the shaker. The point is, you've just been served 4 drinks. Now, I'm not going to tell you not to have 4 drinks, but you should at least know that that's what happened. Like, you definitely can't drive after that. Like, I just think that's a good thing to know. Plus, the gin gets warm. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
It sits there for too long.
Come on, bartenders. Dial it down a little bit.
Yeah. So that and flavored vodkas. That has got to stop.
Oh, go
make
on.
Make it stop. No, I go into all the like hip bars, especially in Eureka. All the hip bars have these absurd cocktail menus with flavored vodkas that aren't flavored with the actual thing. Like it'll say blueberry vodka. No blueberries were harmed in the making of that vodka.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they could be natural flavors, but they're like random plant extracts from a laboratory. It's not like blueberries.
Or sawdust for vanilla vodka.
Right, and it'll be cheap cocktail syrups with synthetic flavorings and high fructose corn syrup. I mean, they're disgusting. They're sweet, they're synthetic, they're gross. And none of them have just like, I mean, make a great Manhattan. Make... You know, very rarely using whiskey, very rarely using other spirits. I just think there must be some vodka distributor in town who goes around and says, here you go, here's your cocktail specials, and just hands them a list of like apple flavored vodka with gross stuff in it. And they call that a drink. They're horrible.
Okay, so we were talking earlier in the building, since you were coming in, oh, Amy's going to be here. It's very exciting. You know, she's New York Times bestselling.
Oh, my God.
And then we realized that you had, there were some plants that you... You know, made the cut, and it seems like it's sort of down to the wire. Like you put aloe in the book, and it seems like that kind of scraped under the wire. But then there are a bunch of drinks that did not get in the book. For instance, as Hank Sims of the Lost Coast Outpost points out, Jepson's Malort not in there. Have you had that? Do you know what Malort is?
What's the plant?
Hey, this is your fault.
I was going to try to stump her on the extabentoon.
Oh, the extabentoon. Do you know about the extabentoon? Hmm. That was another one that's not in the book. Okay.
Yeah. The specialty of Yucatan.
Oh, no. Tell us. Please. Please share.
I couldn't tell you, Amy Stewart. I couldn't tell you, of all people, what is actually in the extabentoon, like the base of it. Hmm. But it is a honey anise liqueur.
Oh, okay.
Very nice.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's probably made with honey and anise, then, I would guess.
Listen,
right?
See, okay. Slap down just like that.
Look at that. All right, well, I've got another one. What kind of plants do you think go into Four Loko?
Oh, I don't know.
Have you had Four Loko?
No, I have not.
You know what it is?
I know. I don't want to know. That's awful.
You got to try
it. No, don't ever drink that.
If you don't need to do anything for 9 days straight, just get yourself a case.
Never do that.
You never get into that world of weird synthetic
alcohol. No, life is short. Drink the good stuff.
It's a lot shorter after you've had Four Loko. I can tell you that. Let's see, Hank. Do you have any questions, by the way? Because we're running a little bit out of time.
I don't have any questions. I feel like I have to make a defense of the 8 ounce drink. A shameful defense. Somebody has to stand up for large drinks, right?
Let's hear it.
What are we going out to drink for, Amy?
No.
The working man, like me.
Have several drinks.
Uh-huh.
Have them one at a time.
Then I pay, though. Then I pay 4 times as much.
Know that you've... Well, I think bars should charge appropriately. I do not think they should charge you $12 for a little drink, right?
Right.
So, all right, price it reasonably.
All right.
But and here's the other thing, too, especially for women. Like, I'll go out with my girlfriends, and some little 100-pound... 70-year-old woman will order a martini, and it's like, that's 4 drinks, girlfriend. Are you okay, honey? Like, I just think it helps if people know what a serving is. That's all.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah. That's totally. I mean,
drink a bunch of them, Hank. Yeah. Please
do harm. I mean, you could really mess somebody
stumble
up.
Stumble home. Oh, okay. Be my guest.
Yeah. Well, I think we have a caller. If that caller is going to hang out for just a sec, we might put them on the air. But I have a question because I know some gluten-free people. I know somebody who...
Oh, yeah.
So 2 questions. First of all, if you wanted to gift your gluten-free friend some nice alcohol, what do you recommend?
Well, okay, so here's the thing. First of all, you can get gluten-free beer, and sorghum is gluten-free, for example. So it's used to make a lot of beer. Distilled spirits are free of gluten because it doesn't survive the distillation process. So whether it's whiskey or vodka or whatever, but some people who are, you know, super concerned about this don't want to go near that because it just scares them. So that's okay. There is going to be new labeling on bottles next year that will straighten all this out and new laboratory testing. So that's going to get better and you'll be able to actually look at the label and see gluten-free. But until then, you could do like Hanger One vodka is made from grapes and it's a beautifully made vodka. So that's an example of something that's gluten-free. Basically, you can look for things with a fruit base.
And what about somebody who's allergic to like corn?
Somebody who's allergic to corn, well, you just got to be really sure because it could be in a lot of whiskeys. I don't know people who are allergic to corn. I don't know what specifically they're allergic to and if that survives the distillation process or not. But if it does, and if that's really a concern, you should know that corn is used in a lot of things. I just gave a talk with the distiller who does aviation gin the other night, and I didn't know that their gin was a corn base. It's 100% corn base alcohol.
Oh, wow.
So, if you're freaked out about that, then you do need to be careful.
Let's see if we have a caller. You've got headphones right there, I think. Yeah. Are you calling for with a question for the Drunken Botanist?
I am calling because I picked up in the middle of the conversation. I work at the Oberon Grill, and I just wanted to put a shout out that we are trying to do everything we can to infuse our own liquors. We make our own sweet and sour from limes and lemons. And there are bars locally that are trying to get away from the processed sugary,
this flavored Stoli regime.
Right. Yeah. Oberon does a nice job. Definitely.
Did you catch the part about serving size? Do you guys like how full are those martini glasses when you serve them?
Well, we pour them. To allow the servers to be able to get the drinks to the tables. We don't give you anything extra. For sure, you know, with our drinks like our Manhattan, we're not shaking that. You're not getting the extra ice in there. We're pouring them to a manageable. You know.
That sounds like they're keeping it classy.
Nice.
You know.
All right. Hey, thank you for the call. That's super nice of you to call in. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right. So look, you're not fighting this fight alone, Amy Stewart.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. Oberon does some nice drinks. Avalon does some... I mean, you know, there's lots of places in town where you can get a nice drink, so definitely. And I will say, too, don't worry about getting a little ice in your drink. Ice and water make a drink taste better.
Sorghum. You talk about sorghum.
Yes.
I had to look it up.
It's a grain that's kind of like millet. It's actually a type of millet, if that helps. And it's grown. See, I wanted this book to be very global. Like, it's easy to look at North America and Europe. But when you start to take Africa into account and you start to take Asia and South America into account, the picture of what we drink around the world really changes. So they make homemade beer throughout Africa, most African nations. And so that's a huge amount of sorghum being used to make alcohol. And in China, they make a high-proof spirit called Mutai, which if you want to come over and have some, I got two bottles, barely touched.
Oh.
It's tough.
It's tough.
It's a little rough, yeah. Yeah.
I've had yak butter tea. That was tough.
That does sound rough. Well, Dan Rather tasted this when he went to China, and he said it tasted like liquid razor blades.
Okay. I'm down for that.
Yeah.
Maybe we could get Larry Trask of the Cocktail Hour down for that, too.
Nice.
What's your favorite drink these days?
You know, I'm drinking a lot of vermouth these days.
And vermouth, like people may not associate that with like a solo standalone kind of drink.
Good vermouth is so drinkable. So in California, there's a great one, Valle, which you can find it in stores, and it's made so nicely that you can drink it by itself. All vermouth is wine that has some herbs and fruit and spices in it, and then a little bit of extra alcohol to bring it up to about 17%. But Imbue Vermouth from Portland is fabulous, and Lillet, which is not a vermouth, but it's also another one of these aperitif wines that's fortified with other plants and with a little alcohol. I really like all of those, and they're very drinkable by themselves.
And then just on the botany front with regards to like massive beer production, okay? So you need fields and fields and fields of barley, right?
Right.
To do this. Do you have a brewery that you think is, you know, organic or not, but like, is there a brewery that you can point to that's doing good harvest practice? Because, you know, when we go to the store and we buy stuff from the co-op,
right? And you want it to be organic. Like, we're stocking our kitchens with organic ingredients.
Sure.
But stuff that we bought that's already put together, it's a lot harder to do.
Right.
Who's doing it right?
Well, you know, it's a tricky question because a lot of breweries don't have either. They don't have a place where they can put it on the label, or they can't get label.
Whoa, they can find a place to put it on the label.
No, no, no. This all the approval, the label approval that they have to go through for this stuff is really tough.
Really?
And all these cuts we're hearing about, all these government cuts. So applications for label approval just sit on the desk of someone who was laid off 6 months ago. It's a huge thing in the liquor industry right now. Getting their labels approved.
That's a thing?
So it's a total thing, yeah. But what I want to say is there are a lot of brewers and distillers who are trying really hard to do GMO-free, local, seasonal. So you'll see a lot of beers that are in the fall that are fresh hop beers or wet hop beers. So rather than just getting their hops in the form of pellets, they're actually getting the fresh, real hops and using them. So there is more interest in that. But a lot of breweries, to be honest, are buying, you know, they're buying their ingredients from large suppliers that supply to a lot of people for a lot of reasons. It's hard to really get a consistent crop week after week, month after month from like just one local farmer, which is why they purchase from like big grain co-ops or big hop co-ops. It's just a tough thing because the product has to be the same. I'm waving this beer bottle around as if our listeners can see that. But anyway, it has to be the same. We, you know, it has to be consistent. And right. That is a hard thing.
I didn't know that label, you know, I'm looking at this is a Dwayne Flatmo picture on the Indica Pale Ale. You know about the yes. controversy behind that, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So they got that approved.
Sure. Sure.
But
yeah. Even all the text, all the logos, all the stuff, it's really a big deal getting your labels approved.
And there aren't even ingredients on this.
No, there's only a few things you have to disclose on the labels. There are a few additives that if you're going to put them in, you have to say what they are. Other than that, yeah, you don't have to say what your ingredients are.
Wow. Well, the book is fun, and we didn't even get a chance to talk about all the weird freak botany people who, like, in some cases, died to give us the drinks that we want.
Yes,
by
they
mistake,
did.
You know.
Right.
This is not like, I will give my life to this beverage, but they're like, ooh, shouldn't have combined those.
Right.
Ooh, there's cyanide in this. Uh-oh.
Right, right. Never have sailed into British waters.
Yeah, oh. I mean, it's those people. I mean, I like the science and I like the botany and I like getting drunk, but I'm drunk right now. But it's those stories, the backstories
right.
Of the people and the trial and error throughout history that has made modern day partying what it is.
Yes.
Is what my favorite part of your book is. So Drunken Botanist, Amy Stewart. It's a New York Times bestseller. And you are going to be at Eureka Theater Arts Alive, 5 p.m.
That's right. Given a talk at 5 and then 6 to 9, books, booze, fundraiser
Raging.
For the theater.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, and plants.
And plants. Yeah, exactly. You've got a line of plants.
Cocktail-friendly plants. We will give them away. So come and get them.
Oh, it's awesome. It is so fun to see you. And I could talk to you all day about your insane existence. But it's a true pleasure. And the book is great. And everybody should buy it.
I could be here all day.
Thank you. Talking about that.
I know. I keep threatening to just live here.
Please.
I will.
Oh, my God. We'll figure a way out for you to continue slumming with us.
Okay, good.
All right. Well, Amy Stewart, you know where to go. Arts Alive, 5 o'clock. We'll be right back. It's K-Hum.